Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
With Marks and Spencer.
On News Talk.
You are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. Very shortly, you will also be listening to Fionnuala Jones, Gene Smullen and Brian Lloyd, who are all here from Movies and Booze. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi. To you all. Brian, what is a Parthenope?
Parthenope is the name of a enclave in Naples. Basically, this is like a two-hour advertisement for a really, really, really expensive perfume. That's what it looks like.
Huh. Right. But a Parthenope is an actual thing.
Yeah. It's like an Italian name for like this quarter in Naples called Parthenope. Oh. And this woman is named after the city that she's in. And she's a sort of a physical manifestation of the city itself and the beauty and the darkness of it.
Right. OK.
It's one of those have you ever seen like those kind of like vaguely kind of dirty Italian films from the 70s? You know, they have these great, but they always have these like great jazz soundtracks. And yeah, it's all like, you know, everyone's beautiful and sad. Mm. Yeah, that's kind of like what this is.
Right, everyone. Yes, right. Yeah. Okay, everyone's philosophical and writing.
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah, everyone's writing each other, but it's all philosophical, and there's a lot of sort of like ennui, and there's a lot of like wistfulness, and there's a lot of like, you know, like smoking beautifully, looking out on a beautiful crisp sea, like Alain Delon. That kind of jam. Like that's what Parthenope is.
Okay, sounds great.
It is actually. That's one of the movies. Enjoyable.
Well, we'll be talking about and the Surfer, Nicolas Cage. Not wistful, I would have thought.
Not wistful. No, just doing far too much in Australia, tackling toxic masculinity and beach bums. Beach, as in like beach kind of like, you know, like bros.
Yeah.
A lot. It's a lot. It's Nicolas Cage, so it's always going to be a lot. It's directed by Lorcan Finnegan, who did previously, did you see Vivarium?
Yeah.
He did that, and he did Without Name, and he did Nocebo, so he's this great horror director. This is a little bit of a departure for him, because it's more kind of closer to, I would say, a satire, like a satire thriller. But again, good crack. Nicolas Cage is always, he's always worth the price of admission, in my mind.
Yeah, but he's being very Nicolas Cagey.
Oh, he's been super cagey. Super cagey, like total, like it takes the whole film for him to get into full cage rage mode, but when he gets there, like he's high on LSD, he's on a beach, he's seeing weird stuff, it's great. Oh no, when he gets there, like, yes,
there's your typecasting there for you. Alright, so what are the two wines today, Jean?
In summary, right? I mean, hell of weather, yes, wonderful, yeah, why not. We've got a rosé, not from Provence, from Languedoc, where you get much better value, and we have, when I said to Rula, we have a red wine pretending it's a rosé. It's a very light kind of new style red wine, lower alcohol, much paler colour, fresher, lighter style, which is very much, you know, in vogue at the moment. So that's what we're looking at today. Okay. One from France, one from Italy.
Right, that Italian looks, it's a very unusual bottle.
It is, it's very distinctive. Yeah, yeah. And I put the pictures of both bottles up on social media. So
and even there. Even from here, the colour of it seems, it's slightly lighter than
it's
a
like sangria.
Than
I was
it kind of is. Yeah.
Okay, so
that's where we're at.
Right. So, Fionnuala, what's the deal with the Phoebe Waller-Bridge? The
scam artist of the century.
Is it kind of all over for her?
Queen,
maybe in a way
of my life. I don't care. Like she's draining Jeff Bezos of every single dollar he has. Yeah. And you know what? I'm up for this. So, and I think I've talked about this a lot over my entire time, probably on the show, where there's various projects. You know, she was working on the Mr. and Mrs. Smith TV series that ended up starring Donald Glover and Maya Erskine. They ended up parting ways, and she ended up producing the show in the end. I think Donald came in and said something, and it was just like creative differences, but like no beef or whatever. She's had this deal with Amazon Prime Video for years and years and years, to the point where it's been like she signed it in 2019 initially, re-signed it again, and then re-signed it again most recently in April of this year, I think. And we're talking like into the hundreds of millions of dollars, right? And she has not turned over anything up until this week. What she has turned out this week, I think it came out yesterday on Amazon Prime Video, is a two-part documentary called Octopus! Exclamation mark. And it's about octopi. I was about to make a total faux pas there and say octopuses, but it's octopi.
No, I think you can say both.
Okay.
You can say octopodes.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. She's narrating. It's like part animated. Tracy Morgan is a talking head for some reason. I mean, she just seems to be like I don't know if this was planned, or as you were kind of positing there, was it just, was Fleabag too big and maybe that was her only thing. Mm. I don't know, because there was talk of a, and I've definitely talked about this before, a Tomb Raider series that they greenlit last year. But I think that's pretty much ended up being scrapped, or like is kind of in a grey area. It's gone through two writers' rooms. They've no script, basically. Like it exists in top line concept only of like, there's a two, we want to do a Tomb Raider adaptation again, and Phoebe Waller-Bridge is some way involved. I like, but then I'm also like, good for you, girl. Take the money and run. You know what I mean? We should all be quiet quitting like this.
Did she produce even this Octopus thing, or she just did the voiceover?
I think she's just voiceovering it, yeah. Which is, again, so incredible.
Essentially, Amazon are giving her $20 million a year to do nothing.
Yeah.
Well, it's given with the intention that she will turn in something, and she hasn't turned in anything, and they're not calling her on it. And like,
how can that happen?
I think it was essentially like, well, it wasn't a blank check, but they wrote her that check being like, oh my God, you did Fleabag and it was incredible and it was hugely successful for Prime and stuff like that. And it's still considered like one of the greatest. I only watched it very recently and I cannot believe I let it go that long without watching it. But I think it was just she's done this. It was so good. She'll definitely do something else. Really incredible. And it's like, maybe, I don't know.
But this isn't like, it was funny as you were saying it, because like she worked on No Time to Die. She was one of the, she did a polish on it, right? And famously, what's her face? Barbara Broccoli basically said, although those Amazon Prime people are idiots. They just don't know what they're doing. So it wouldn't surprise me in the slightest if she has turned in stuff and they're like, yeah, we're not going to make this. And she's like, okay, well, my end of the deal is done here. I handed this in and you didn't like it. But that's not what I remember reading one of the stories. I think it was either in Deadline or Variety. And it's like, she's turned in nothing. I mean,
that seems to be the gender consensus, is like the work is not being
done at all, but they're still paying her, which after a while it's kind of like, okay, this is your fault now. Like, I mean, if you're...
Oh, no, absolutely.
But yeah, we're talking
beggars
like,
belief, no matter how stupid they are, that you'd give someone $20 million a year for nothing.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't want that job?
Yeah. I mean, unless it's one of those things where it's like, they don't want her going over to Netflix or Disney and making
and
stuff
doing
for
nothing
them.
For them.
But you know what I mean? Like, it's in, like, there is that thing of like gardening leave and it's like, we're paying you to just stay away. Like, so maybe that's what they're doing. They don't want her creating stuff for Netflix, which
looks like a really shrewd move.
Like, I mean, I'm trying to rationalize this, but 20 million a year to do nothing. I mean, Jesus, talk about, you know, failing upward. Like, that's incredible. Like,
does that mean she can't do anything else though?
The deals have kind of changed as the years have gone. I think this most recent deal that she signed is like a first look deal with Amazon, which I don't really
It's basically like if she comes up with an idea, she has to give it to Amazon
to
Prime first,
yeah.
And they have basically first refusal on it.
Okay.
And then if they have something, they can give it to her. They'll give her the first look at it and they'll say, okay, do you want to make this Phoebe Waller-Bridge? Which she'll probably say, nah, not for me, thanks. And just keep collecting our money.
Apart from a documentary about octopuses.
Mm. Well, I mean, I'd watch it.
Yeah, oh no, I'm sure it'll be
very
diverting.
Yeah, to watch it now.
Oh my God, there'll be a book in that at some point.
Mm.
Fleabag was an amazingly horrible, self-indulgent pile of crap, says the texter.
No,
I couldn't
no.
understand how anyone got past the first few episodes. I really hated it.
Okay.
You are in the minority.
You are in the minority, yeah.
Sir, which of course it's a man.
Yeah.
I don't know, there's no name. Could have been.
I'll give you a 5-1 that's a man.
Don't be hating on men so much. Poor men. They're having a hard time. Actually, softly, I saw the stage...
The stage
in London, yeah.
Is it good?
Oh, yeah, it was fantastic. Yeah.
I kind of think it probably does operate even better as a show, especially that first season. You know what I mean? Like, I can understand why people maybe didn't stick with it, but it is worth sticking with. Especially Andrew Scott in the second season, and their chemistry is just off the charts.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the show was really the first season, but I suppose so it's more kind of compact in that way that she does it. But she came out and, you know, talk to people queuing up to get in and did selfies with people and stuff.
Yeah, I heard that. And yeah, like there was one of the performances, she came out with Andrew Scott and started handing out G&T in a can to everybody that was waiting and stuff like that.
Incredible.
Yeah.
I love her.
Remake Octopussy with Daniel Radcliffe as the Roger Moore character and Phoebe Waller-Bridge as the octopus. Okay, I don't think you quite got a handle on the plot of Octopussy there. So it's going to be a best podcast category in the Golden Globes. Are you excited for nearly? Are you going to enter for this?
So excited. Well, sure, we could enter Movies and Booze. We could be a part. We could be speaking in history now.
Yeah.
Us
we could make a long, tedious speech someplace.
Golden Globe winning podcast. Yes, they're bringing in this category for next year's ceremony. It's going to be chosen among the 25 most listened to podcasts, quote, that have made a significant impact over the past year, celebrating the creativity and influence of creators worldwide. But they haven't given, like, there's no, I'm sure there's going to be more specific eligibility, but they've said that's going to be coming in the coming weeks. Golden Globes, obviously next taking place January 11th, 2026. They're kind of saying that it's recognising how much the entertainment world is changing, and I suppose, like, I get that. I am kind of like, why is this not like a, if it's an audio medium, why didn't the Grammys do it first or probably at all? Because, like, the thing is, right, and this is where I'm going to get a bit old man yells at cloud, right, because of how much podcasts have changed and because they have become like nearly a visual medium as well, and so many people are watching podcasts, and that's fine, but that's also not what they existed as originally.
Initially.
And I think people are getting into podcasting, particularly celebrities. And they're TV shows. They're not podcasts. They're calling them podcasts, but they're essentially like TV productions,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
Even like the most like the Amy Poehler Good Hang, which I do really like, but that's functioning as a TV show in my opinion. I think she sees that as well. So like, I don't know. And I this is going to be like the smartless lads are going to win it. You know what I mean?
No, well, they're saying the most listened to podcast.
But
we're
then
saying
that's also it as well. It's not like, I'm not being funny. Like, there's so many people listening to like a lot of
crap.
SH1T.
Oh,
yeah,
no, absolutely.
I mean?
So but if
just
only,
say shit, Manu. Just say shit.
If they're only choosing the six biggest, most listened to podcasts, that
it's
means,
gonna be Joe
and
Rogan.
Yeah, exactly. And who wants to see Joe Rogan, like, you know, sniffing into his t-shirt, you know, saying, oh, no, I don't know where that nosebleed came from, and rambling on.
Is
for
he gonna
4 hours.
Even be able to get up as far as the lectern? People forget he's like 5 foot nothing.
Is he? Yeah.
He's tiny.
Okay, I've never seen him stand up, so I don't know.
There you go. That's why he's in the podcast.
James says, Phoebe Waller-Bridge is one of the most overrated writers and actresses of the last 20 years. Fleabag is overrated nonsense. Beggars belief that people rave about it. She also destroyed the recent woke Indiana Jones reboot,
Jesus,
where her character only seemed to be there to wag the finger at Harrison Ford on behalf of Gen Z, telling him what an awful old-fashioned man he is. Woeful, says James.
I don't agree with the Fleabag characterization, because I really like it, but I think there is also a question, like, I wonder if she is a stronger writer than a, because we haven't seen anything else, like, it's really hard to, I also haven't seen that Indiana Jones, so I can't comment on that, but it does beg the question, is she a bit, is, was it one and done? Was this her unicorn and like that's it?
She made no particular difference to that Indiana Jones thing.
Yeah, but I also don't think she, like, again, having not seen it, I doubt she is the issue with that. Like, you know what I mean? We're doing Indiana Jones again in whatever year that was.
Yeah,
who
true.
Cares?
Who cares is right.
Sorry.
Let's have a drink, Jane.
Okay, quite a sense if y'all need one, right?
Yeah.
Okay, now we're going, starting with the rosé. Provençal rosé, about mid-2005, a guy called Sacha Lachine, he bought an estate down in the south of France called Château d'Escalin, and he decided that he was going to make a bone dry rosé, and with very little sugar in it, almost virtually no sugar in it. And that became Whispering Angel, and that started the trend. And now everybody is going after these really bone dry rosés with about 1 gram of residual sugar. And everywhere you go, that is now very much in demand, right? Mm. Also, organic, everything. What Lachine did was actually, he has a fermentation process which manages to keep the character of the fruit and the sort of some characteristics going, and some, you know, it keep the wine interesting, even though there's very little sugar in it. So it kind of changed the face of the global wine market. But now what's happening is everybody's looking for these really pale pink. And this actually has a pretty label again. I put a picture of it up on social media. Les Magnolias is the name of the wine. It's a rosé, but it's actually not from Provence. It's from Languedoc. Now, the Languedoc, which was formerly Côte de Languedoc, is one of the key appellations in the south of France. Best known mainly for its red wines, 75% of their production is red wine, but increasingly for white and rosé. And they use the native grapes, Sanso, Grenache and Syrah, to make this wine. And I think this is actually a fabulous, a really summery wine for a summer day. Now, it's available in O'Brien's, and you know they're all over the place. And they're mainly Greater Dublin, but they're countrywide as well. it's this, you know, it's a Provençal lookalike. So you got the pale pink colour, you got the lots and lots of summery fruits, you know, very much kind of strawberry on the nose. And when you taste it, it's dry. Now, it's not bone dry. It's not Whispering Angel dry. It is a dry wine, but there's a lovely kind of almost bitter cherry twist on this that I actually like. It's got kind of the elegant fruit, a little bit of complexity, and, you know, not in the same price range as the Whispering Angel and its minty and all those.
Yeah.
So if you're looking for something that's, you know, as good quality and as well made, definitely worth a look.
Okay, yeah.
And actually, it's very nice. O'Brien's have lots of, they're doing a rosé thing at the moment, so because it is rosé season, let's be honest. And now's the time. If you're not going to drink rosé now, you're never going to drink. So,
absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. No, that was a lovely choice, Jean. Brian, Sad Bonking Italians?
Yes.
Yeah, Sad Bonking Italians coming up after this.
My name is Partenope.
John Cheever.
I've read all of your stories.
Well, life's full of misfortunes.
What are you doing?
Oh, the usual. Taking a long, sad walk.
May I join you?
No.
Why not?
Because I don't want to steal one minute of your youth from you.
There you go. Exclusive audio from inside the conclave from last night. Right. Parthenope?
Yes, you see, because it is so very sensual.
Yeah.
But also so very sensual.
Yes, of course.
That's basically what you heard. Like, that's like,
it's, I really don't know if that was Italian, but anyway.
But it is so very sensual, you understand?
No, it's like you basically heard the entirety of the English language. And I'm not even joking. Like, the only person in it that speaks English in that film is Gary Oldman and the Celeste Dellanota. This is directed by Paolo Sorrentino, who previously did The Great Beauty, if you ever saw that. He did This Must Be the Place, that was shot here in Ireland with Sean Penn, and was shot up in Bono's house. He's known for making these gorgeous, I mean beautiful looking films that are just, they just comes out of the screen how gorgeous it is. And this is really what this film is about. It's the idea of like, okay, you can be absolutely beautiful, you can be absolutely accomplished and smart the way the titular character is, but what does that actually run you at the end of the day? What does that actually lead to? Is beauty in and of itself destructive? You know, that sort of way. Because the whole thing of it is that she's born, she has a younger brother, and the younger brother is obsessed with her. And it, of course, as you would imagine, turns incestuous, because it's just the obsession gets to that point where it hits it. And you know, the film has this great kind of idea that, like, you know, there's this great line which really just sums up the entire film, is that, like, you know, desire is a mystery, but sex is its funeral. And that idea of, like, you know, the mystery of, like, wanting something but not being able to touch it, not being able to reach it, is that more exciting? Is that more kind of, you know, invigorating than actually being able to put your hand on it and stuff like that? Which is all basically a way of saying that, like, as you hear there, they're basically walking through these beautiful places, having these very philosophical conversations. And, you know, it's all gorgeous and beautiful, but they're all so sad, you know, that sort of way. And everything in it looks amazing. Like, Yves Saint Laurent produced this and, like, gave all the clothes in it as well. So even the clothes that they're wearing looks amazing as well. It's not for everybody. I mean, it's an art house film. Like, I mean, that's what Paolo Sorrentino is. So, like, you're going into it with the expectation that, A, it's not going to resolve itself in a way that you necessarily like, and that a lot of time in this film is going to be dedicated solely to you just looking at the composition of the shot and the colours and the clothes and the music and the everything else. And what they're doing is almost, like, further down the list of things that you should be appreciating. So go into it with that kind of notion that this is not, like, your standard drama narrative. You know, there are plenty of other films out there you can watch. If you want a feast of the senses, this is the thing to watch.
Okay, but in terms of what narrative there is...
Oh, it's so boring. Like,
Is it about the relationship between the brother and the sister?
The brother and... It's basically her going through her life and her kind of experiences with beauty. Because, like, in the first kind of act of the film is this incestuous relationship, or this incestuous obsession that her brother has with her, that she... not necessarily ignores, but sort of is aware of it, but tries to push it to one side. And then the middle part of the film is where she's kind of puts her studies on hold. She's an anthropology student, and she puts it on hold to become an actor. And she goes off and meets with this agent who then puts her onto this sort of fading star that's basically like a thinly veiled caricature of Sophia Loren, who wears a wig and just absolutely hates Naples and, you know, is kind of backbiting about her agent and all the rest of it. And there's, I should say as well, like, there are parts of this film that are just ridiculously politically incorrect. Like, there's a whole joke about the fact that the agent says the actress likes anal sex, and then the actress says the agent likes anal sex, and it's like, but I don't have any problem with that. And it's almost kind of like, that's, yeah, and you're kind of like, is that meant to be funny?
Yeah.
You're kind of like, is that meant to be a joke?
What period is this set in?
Oh, the 70s. Like, it's all right, the 70s. Okay. Like, yeah. Which again kind of feeds into the thing of like, okay, it was a different time period. You know, social media is not a thing. You know, it's this sort of, and again, you know, Italy in the 70s, this was the years of lead, like, you know, that sort of way. Like, I mean, you had all these, like, criminal gangs going around killing each other. But here in Partenope, in Naples, it's all beautiful and everyone is just, you know, unbelievably good looking and sad.
Yeah.
So,
and yeah. What does Gary Oldman do in this?
He's an American author that Partenope meets and she's obsessed with him, but he rejects her, of course, because he's so sad himself. Like, he's like trying to drink himself to death. And when he talks to her, he's like, he tells her about, you know, beauty is so fading and I don't want to be anywhere near you because I'm ugly and for us to be together would be so terrible. But she's like, but you're beautiful on the inside. And he goes, no, I'm not. I'm uglier on the inside. And it's all, you know.
Crikey.
I enjoyed it for what it is, but yeah. Again, I fully admit that, you know, seven people could watch this and be bored to tears and three people might get something out of it, so.
Yeah, somebody's texting in to say the clip you played sounded like a fast show scene.
Oh no, yeah, totally. Like, remember, like, there was on the fast show, they used to have, like, the French New Wave kind of skits, like, and stuff like that. Your feet are beautiful. It's like something like that. Like, you could totally take the mickey out of this film, like, and it is kind of almost parodying itself in some parts, how beautiful and how kind of, like, you know, self-aware it is, you know?
Yeah, I'd agree with Brian. His films are beautiful to look at. A great beauty. Did look fantastic, but let's be honest, it was fairly dull.
It is.
Says Orla. James says Sorrentino also directed The Young Pope and The New Pope.
That's right.
Two unmissable HBO series starring Jude Law and John Malkovich, respectively. They're a must-watch.
They are, but they're hard to find. The Young Pope isn't on Now TV anymore. It used to be on it. It's gone now. I think The New Pope is still there. But yeah, The Young Pope is brilliant. Jude Law running around half naked being a priest, or being the Pope, rather, I should say, is nuts.
Yeah. Okay. Now, while Donald Trump is going to make American films great again.
So he says.
Yeah, so he says. Now, no one knows how that's going to work exactly. Mm. But the technical end of film and TV making is still leaving Los Angeles, if that be fair.
Yeah, you're even having the likes of, like, I feel like, again, to go back to these celebrity podcasts or whatever, there was a clip that kind of went viral around the time of Severance, because it was Adam Scott on Rob Lowe's podcast talking about the fact that Rob Lowe hosts this game show called The Floor that they film in Ireland. Like, and he says in the podcast, like, it's cheaper to fly. And The Floor, I don't fully understand the premise, but, like, there's lots of people involved, basically, and it's like head-to-head kind of trivia battles. A lot of contestants involved. And he says it's basically cheaper to fly all those people over to Ireland and shoot it there than it is to film in Los Angeles, and they're kind of lamenting that or whatever. But there's this really interesting piece in The Hollywood Reporter this week that talks about how, even though, like, TV and film isn't really, you know, Los Angeles isn't the hub for it anymore, kind of YouTube and, like, short form social media content is, like, moving in. There's some really interesting, again, creators that I wouldn't have been familiar with before this. There's a guy called Alan Chicken Chow. And he has this anthology series called Alan's Universe. And it's like kind of Disney Channel stuff, right? But he's over 80 million subscribers on YouTube. He's just opened up this 10,000 square foot studio to film all his content in. Like, they have, like, different sets for wherever the scenarios are set up or whatever. And you're having all these people come back and say, like, the advertisers are still putting money into, like, there is work there, but it's just maybe not necessarily in legacy media per se. And then even take away or to leave the kind of creator side of it for a second, like, even these creators are working with people, like, they've interviews with, like, casting directors who've left Hollywood, like, we're talking from, like, Discovery and Paramount and stuff like that, and kind of other positions in again, traditional legacy media companies like Disney or whatever, to go work with people like, again, these sports creators that I've never heard of. They're called Dude Perfect, but again, they're like sports, comedy, skits, stuff like that. They're after opening an 80,000 square foot headquarters that's like, they have like football fields and stuff like that. Obviously stuff to do sports on. It's not just like filming sets, we'll say. They have like over 60 million subscribers. It's just very interesting considering like you have the traditional media people being like, we want to go back, we want to film in LA, but it's like it is happening, but it's just not happening
the way they want it to.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating.
I'd say they're probably just holding out for a tax break. That's the whole thing. John Voight seemingly went to Trump and he was all like, look, we need to kind of reinvigorate American productions. We need to reinvigorate LA. Best way to do that is, you know, provide like a federal tax relief scheme for productions in America. And Trump was like, no, we're going to put 100% tariff on all foreign films. And like, Trump being Trump, of course, there's no way that's going to work because, like, how can
no,
you,
it's impossible.
It's impossible because like you can have an Italian director, you can have, you know, the script written by an American, 3 out of 5 cast can be American, but then the special effects, the CGI could be done here in Ireland, the editor could be in Australia or something like that. So like, it's just stupid, like.
But the reason why these kind of YouTube, like,
it doesn't
these
sound like Trump at all. I don't know what you're talking about.
The reason why these creators are also succeeding then is because, like, and again, this is not to compare because it's apples and oranges. Like this, you know, like your man, Alan's Universe guy. Like this is short form, like very kind of telenovela for teenagers. Like you're not going to compare that to like
an entire series.
But like there is an argument then that like with these creators, they're kind of, because of how they're doing it and stuff like that, they're like writers, producers, often stars in one. You know, that kind of way. So it's just like, it's inherently different, but I can kind of understand why people are leaving the legacy media to be like, well, the advertisers still love this and I can just do it one person.
You got to work. Right, so what's going on in the Lilo and Stitch movie? Lilo and Stitch.
Okay, are you familiar with the animated movie?
No.
Okay, well, there's an alien comes to Hawaii, essentially, crash lands in Hawaii, and she thinks it's a dog and it becomes her pet. Really, really good. I'm not really selling it with that description. But basically, there are these other aliens that come to Earth to get Stitch back, because obviously he's not supposed to belong on Earth.
Yeah.
One of them is called Pleakley, and in the animated film, Pleakley is like a bit of a cross-dresser, like that, and like that's not in correct language. Like they basically have to go undercover to get Stitch, and like he's wearing dresses and he's become like a fan favourite, essentially. Like people found that very endearing because it's the comedy of the character. Like it's very buddy cop, you know, the odd couple with the other fella, Jumba, I think is his name, the other guy who he's trying to catch Stitch with. The live action, which is coming out very soon, it's coming out, I think, May 23rd. Yeah, May 23rd. Come to cinemas. Basically, in the live action, there's no cross-dressing involved. So he's basically has some technology where it's like they've just become humans. And people are outraged about this. People are like, put Pleakley in a dress. This is insane. How dare you? To the point where the director, Dean Fleischer-Camp, has had to come out and say, I tried, but doesn't really give any explanation as to why it didn't happen.
Has shown
like drawings of like what Pleakley would have looked like in a dress and a wig and stuff like that. But yeah, I'd say that was just Disney being like, can you not do this? Because we have a lot of money riding on this and we want to antagonize the insane far right people who will say we're corrupting children with aliens and dresses. You know
what
I mean?
This is the thing I don't get, right? They're going to say that no matter what. It doesn't matter. Like satisfying these people, like they'll just keep.
Oh no! But why give them a target? I suppose might have been the logic
maybe,
there.
Yeah.
Even still, though, it's really crazy, right? Okay, you are listening to the Moncrief Show, and you thought we do have to take a break. More of this after that. There'll be a new total on the hard shoulder after the 4 o'clock news. So let's celebrate Michael's success. Tell us about this wine, Gene.
We're staying with Italy, and this is the 2024 Fresco di Masi Rosso IGT Bio, and it's in Nolan Supermarkets, O'Brien's, and Next Door Nationwide. Now, if there's any name to associate with the wine region, it's Masi. The Boscanini family have been making wines there since 1772. Fresco di Masi is brand new wine, organic wine, produced by Giacomo Boscanini, who is now running the business. He's the seventh generation of his family to make the wines. the whole thing, I mean, you commented about the bottle. They use, it's sustainably produced using wild yeast. It's biodynamic, not aged in wood, a lower alcohol content. So this one has 11.5% ABV, lighter bottle. It's very much on trend. Like in the wine, you're talking films and, you know, trends in films. We were talking about that earlier on. This is what the demand is. Now, red wine, only accounts for 45% of all wine sales on the Irish market. Like white is in much more demand, and so are rosé. Well, rosé is only 7% of the market, but still, red wine, people have gone, they don't want to drink big, heavy, Cabernet Sauvignon based, you know, lots of tannin with lots of vanilla and sort of structure. They want light, they want fruit, and more importantly now, and this is the big trend, lower alcohol. That's very much what's happening. So this has been created by the Boscanini family under the Mazzi label, and it's called Fresco di Mazzi, and it's great. There's a white in the range as well, which is also from the Veneto region, and it's Garganega and Chardonnay. It's very typical style, a white style as well. So I think this is lovely, and I know you all tried it there, and you all, fresh, light, and with a nice level of alcohol, lots of cherry fruit, very kind of Veronese in style, and, you know, perfect for summer drinking. Absolutely, yeah. You know.
It's really nice. Indeed. Yeah. Really, really nice.
Right, so hasn't Andy Serkis been working on a Gollum movie for like 10 years or something? It feels like that.
For so long, and this isn't coming out until 2027 now, because I think I talked about it when it was officially announced last year.
Poor man.
Well, I mean, he seems very excited about it because he's directing it and he's starring in it and everything else. But yeah, the Lord of the Rings film, The Hunt for Gollum, will be coming to theatres December 17th, 2027. As I just mentioned, he's starring in it and directing it. And it's two of the original Lord of the Rings writers, Fran Walsh and Philippa Boyens, are on board as well. This is going to matter to the Lord of the Rings people. Basically, the story takes place after the birthday party of Bilbo and before the mines of Moria. And it's quite an intense story. He says we've no other cast lined up, though. A few of the original fellas like Ian McKellen and Orlando Bloom and Viggo Mortensen have said two thumbs up, we'd do it, because it's probably two thumbs up to lots of money. But nothing officially confirmed yet, so.
But they don't get, okay, can I?
Yes,
please, because know absolutely nothing.
Right, so basically the whole thing of it is that when the Fellowship makes their way up the mountain and gets to the Mines of Moria, that's when they initially kind of meet Gollum.
Yeah.
But Gollum has already been there the whole time. Gollum has basically been following the Fellowship because he's following the ring.
Yeah.
So I would imagine you could probably see them off in the distance. I'd say they wouldn't be actually in it, because the minute you put them in it, it automatically becomes, hey, it's Gandalf and it's Aragorn and it's blah, 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 blah. So I'd imagine if they were mentioned in it, they would be far away, because the idea is that Gollum... What?
No, it's just funny. I'm just imagining
So it's kind of how we got there. Correct. Kind of. Time. Isn't there a book about Gollum?
There was a Silmarillion, and then there was The Hobbit. The Hobbit was, but he was mentioned in The Hobbit, but again, he wasn't like a central character. And he was way more detailed anyway in like The Lord of the Rings. Like, they took out, like, I mean, the people forget, like, the film and the book are like, you're talking one part versus like 10 parts. The book is so much more. There's an entire character that was just cut out of the film because they didn't have Tom Bombadil.
Yeah.
But he comes into the TV series, like, so yeah, there's a whole, I could be here all day, I'll stop.
Okay.
It's Gollum Girl right. Summer anyway for 2027. You were there first.
So. Has Andy Serkis been doing anything else? Although he has done other things. He's not like tied to this forever.
No, he hasn't. No, but I think this is a passion project.
He's been trying to get big. Like, he directed like Venom 2, and like he wants to get more into kind of directing and stuff like that. Like, it's weird. He's a good actor. This is the thing. He's a great actor. Like, I mean, did you ever see that Ian Dury biopic that he did?
That's
what I'm saying. He's great in that. Yeah. Like, I mean, I think it's one of those things that he probably just likes directing more than he likes acting. Because whenever he gets to act, they probably just want him to do CGI and they don't get to see his face or whatever. But like, I don't know. I'm excited. I want to see it. I mean, when this was announced, it was like, great. And then it's like, Jesus, here we are 3 years later and still nothing. Like, so I don't know.
Yeah, but that usually implies a difficulty with funding or cast or
I can't imagine. I can't imagine there's a problem of funding for this. Like, it's Lord of the Rings. Like,
yeah,
come on. Like.
That's true. Yeah.
Or cast if three of them have been like, yeah, we would do it. Do you know what I mean? So it must just be again.
But don't people just say that because actors are hypocrites?
True. Fair point.
That's that. Yeah. Anyway, we'll move on to our second movie. It's called The Surfer. Here's Nicolas Cage shouting.
I told you to wait up in the car park.
I want my surfboard.
Okay. I'm sure it's just a mix-up. Is it one of these?
Dude, that's my board, and I want it back.
Listen, mate, I think you've been out in the sun too long.
They took it from me last night. They threatened me with a broken bottle.
Why don't you take a drink of water?
I don't want anything from you. I want my board.
So you're saying they took this from you last night?
Was I not clear?
Well, it's just the problem is, and I can tell you myself, that old board's been up there for as long as I can remember.
Right, okay. Yeah. This is a, you know that, I forget the name, the one where he had a pig and somebody took the pig off him?
Yeah,
and
then, it was called Pig.
So is this like basically Pig but with a surfboard?
Kind of not really. I mean, all right.
No, it's like conceptually Pig. Different. Or is it a different
thing? Well, for one, Pig was like quite an emotional film, if you recall. Like, it was really, like, he was brilliant in it, but he had this like really wounded kind of sensibility. Where in this, it's comedic, like he's almost pathetic, like, you know, that sort of, because he's soon to be divorced. He's trying to buy this house near the beach to kind of win back his wife and try to, you know, repair the relationship.
Is this in Australia?
It's in Australia. He initially was born in Australia but then moved to California, and that explains the accent. And weirdly enough, I actually found the fact that he had an American accent and everyone else had an Australian accent, it kind of added to the whole, the sort of the alienation of it, like, you
right,
know, like,
okay.
in a way, like, it kind of worked rather than worked against it. It's kind of like, I'm trying to think of a kind of something I could compare it to, but it's part horror, it's part satire, it's part comedy. Like, there are parts of it that are very, very funny, and then there are other parts of it where it gets really, like, you know, very funny and disturbing. Like, there's a whole set piece in it where he basically takes like LSD and he's like tripping balls on the beach, and like, you know, everyone's eyes are like rolling over and stuff like that, and he's like going full Cage freak out and stuff like that, and that's always fun, like, when you see him going nuts. But then there are other scenes in it where, you know, like, he's just like just trying to get a coffee or something like that, and like, he's lost his phone, and like, they won't give him a free coffee and stuff like that. And it's all about, basically, the whole film is that he has to lose everything to gain what he wants, but that isn't really what happens, because, you know, well, I don't want to ruin it, but the whole film is essentially he's trying to buy this house, and one bad thing keeps happening after the other. Like, it turns out the wife just wants to divorce, and the son isn't really interested in surfing with him. And when he tries to get down to the beach, these locals basically are like, no, this is a locals only beach. Go surf somewhere else. You'll be happier elsewhere down the way. He's like, no, I grew up here. I'm surfing here. I have a right to this. And again, that kind of, you know, thematically, the film is about sort of, you know, toxic masculinity and the idea of, you know, this notion that people are the entitlement of masculinity, that like, oh, I lived here. Like, of course, I'm a man. Why shouldn't I get what I want? Why shouldn't I have all these things that I want? And it's like, no, you're not entitled to that at all.
Yeah.
You know, just because, you know, you have money and, you know, some sort of status, that does not mean that you can step over people. Sure, society might be set up that way, but that is inherently unjust, you know, that sort of way. So, like, there are a lot of kind of things going on with it. And, you know, Lorcan Finnegan, like, previous films he did, like, you know, Sebo, for example, was basically all about fast fashion and the idea of, you know, a fashion designer who basically is using cheap labour abroad, but then that ends up destroying an entire factory and everyone dies in it, and the spirit comes back to haunt her and stuff like that. And it's brilliant. It's really, really good. And, like, Without Name was like this Brian De Palma-esque horror film set in the woods in Ireland, and it was freaky as hell. And Vivarium was all about suburban kind of, you know, terror and all the rest of it. So, like, he's really good at kind of taking something that probably isn't that scary and making it absolutely terrifying. But in this, he doesn't really have that sort of, he doesn't have the horror to rely on, if you know that kind of way. He's got to go find other things to kind of make it more kind of tense and more kind of weird. And he's helped in that regard by Julian McMahon, who people would know from Nip Tuck. And he plays this, like, sort of manosphere, you know, shaman, if you like, that is antagonizing Nicolas Cage. And he's brilliant in it because there's something about his eyebrows. They're like so manicured and he has like such a sharp jaw that you almost think he's like made out of AI or something when he appears on screen. You're like, oh, there's something so otherworldly about him, you know. But he's brilliant. Like they're both great together. Like they have great kind of chemistry on screen. They really kind of bump off each other. Again, like kind of Parthenope, not for everyone, but if you can get on board with Cage Rage, you're going to enjoy this.
Yeah, and these are in cinemas as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, both in cinemas.
Both in cinemas. Right, Fionnuala Brian, Gene, thank you all very much.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
With Marks and Spencer.
On News Talk.